You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. With the wildfire season upon us, we're going to take a look back at last year's campfire, the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California's history. It decimated the town of Paradise, destroyed 19,000 structures, and took the lives of 85 people. In its aftermath, writer and journalist Mark Arak spent months digging into the reasons for such a deadly blaze. I spoke with him about his investigative piece called Gone, which is out this week in the California Sunday Magazine. So you start the story with a tour of Paradise 4 months after the fire, and your guide is a young mother and resident who takes you to the spot where the home she grew up in once stood, and it was a home like thousands of other structures that had been demolished by the fire. And you ask her this question that becomes kind of the basis for your article. Did fire come to Paradise, or did Paradise come to the fire? And what you find is kind of a perfect storm of greed, corruption, bad forestry policies, free-for-all development that sets up Paradise for this unbelievable disaster. So let's start with the town. By the 70s, there were scores of housing tracts without sidewalks or gutters or buffers to provide a space against fire. A municipal sewage system was never constructed, and essentially it was a city with no governance.
Yeah, I thought when I asked her that question, did fire come to Paradise or did Paradise go to fire, it was kind of an unfair question to ask her. That's why I was there. And so almost as soon as I asked her the question, I kind of brushed it away. But that's the question that kind of defines the piece. This is a gold rush town. So it started off in that supercharged way, and then when gold left the mountain, lumber became the new gold, and then agriculture, and then suburbia. You know, when I went up there, I thought, okay, we're going to have one of these mountain villages that we see, like Shaver or something, right? Shaver's gotten big itself. But this was a whole sprawling suburbia, and they called it the Town of Paradise. The town with the future was the slogan. But it was really a whole city, almost like it had been taken and lifted the model from Los Angeles or something. 40,000 people were living on this ridge, and it had grown in the most untrammeled way. And I found these women. Well, one named Pam Figge, who started off as a reporter, then became a town planner, and then became a professor at Chico State, which is 15 miles down the ridge. And another one named Jane Dolan, who kind of recreated the atmosphere of growth that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s there. Figge remembers a process called 4x4ing. I'd never heard that term. But basically, you know, you have this influential businessman in Paradise. It could be anybody. And he buys a parcel, and the supervisors, because back then the Board of Supervisors made all the land use decisions in Paradise. And they agree to his request to divide the parcel into four pieces. Then he sells one of those four pieces to a friend or a family member or a partner. And then that person goes before the same board and wins approval to divide his piece into four. So on and on, you have this four, four, four slicing and dicing. Why the number four? It wasn't arbitrary. You know, had they split it into five, they would have had to follow state law, subdivision law. And the developers would have had to pay for proper infrastructure.
And you do mention some whistleblowers. In 1998, there was one spunky couple who sued Paradise for its refusal to require sewers and roads to escape fire. The town was forced to hire planners and follow zoning codes, but it was essentially too late.
It was too late. There were 30,000 people by that time living in the suburban equivalent of a tinderbox.
On top of development, there's also these huge forestry issues. You've got this really interesting source, Richard Wilson, who ran the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection in the 1990s. And he talks about how the forests essentially weren't managed.
So he gave me an education. I mean, he said that he didn't think we could have managed the forest any worse. So, you know, he started with the Indians, who gave us this natural forest. And it was patchy. You know, that's the thing. When you look at old photos, you see that the forest back in the 1840s was patchy, and these trees grew to differing heights, and that was a healthy forest. You know, the wall-to-wall trees that we look at, kind of a form of agriculture on the mountain,
It's not natural.
That's not natural. It's not healthy. And so the combination of open ground and this uneven canopy back in pre-settlement days kept the fires from raging. And the fires were natural. And when they burned, by lightning strike usually was the spark, they kind of burned themselves out. They scorched the forest floor. They thinned out the lower branches and shrubs. That allowed the taming of the next fire, but it also allowed these new trees to generate. Instead, the timber companies then come in, and they don't work inside those natural cycles. They're pumping out wood. They're pumping out trees, and they're planting one tree on top of the other. And Richard Wilson said that this was this uniform growth. When fire hit it, it becomes a blowtorch. The trees are nothing but matchsticks.
So we've got untrammeled development, we've got unmanaged forest, and then I also noticed one of the more interesting twists in the story is the evolution of CAL FIRE, almost at the expense of forest rangers, because the services that the forest rangers were performing, such as reducing fuel loads in mountain communities, were curtailed and ranger numbers dwindled, yeah. Firefighters increased, the department existed almost as a partner with towns such as Paradise.
That's right. So you've got these factors. You've got the untrammeled growth. You've got the kindling of the human settlement, and now the kindling of the mismanaged forest. And then on top of that, you have CAL FIRE changing its role, its purpose. It's very uniform. It went from khaki, the khaki of the ranger, to the blue of the firefighter. And that wasn't just a change in uniform. That was a change in mission. The ranger found himself a second-class citizen in a department he once commanded. So the services he performed, you know, which were coordinating prescribed burns, protecting watersheds from the rack of clear cuts, reducing those fuel loads in the mountain communities, those were all curtailed. And what took place instead was this structuring of California firefighting into what is a disaster industrial complex. Now, fighting fire is like this warlike mobilization that requires helicopters and air tankers and, you know, these machines that cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And that becomes its own kind of reality.
So, in other words, the department is existing because there are towns like Paradise.
The state of California and all its agencies, including CAL FIRE, they never tell these communities, hey, the growth that you're bringing to this mountain, it's dangerous, it's courting disaster. Instead, CAL FIRE ends up serving that growth. It becomes the fire department of the mountain communities. And this is what Richard Wilson bemoans, because not only did they keep quiet, they ended up profiting off that footprint expanding more and more into the wildland-urban interface. I mean, the numbers of Californians in the wildland-urban interface, I mean, it's grown extraordinarily. I mean, in the last, we have 10 million Californians, a quarter of our population living in the path of wildfire, and it keeps getting, growing every decade.
And you brought up Richard Wilson again. Another thing that he found was that there was this linear pattern of ignition clusters that corresponded to major electrical power lines. So that brings us to another element in this perfect storm, which is PG&E.
We have the mismanagement of growth, the mismanagement of the forest. That's the kindling. And then we have the spark. And the spark turns out to be PG&E. And I go back with the help of legal documents and find how PG&E has this culture of corruption and malfeasance, and it goes back decades. And when I talk to some of the lawyers who are representing some of the victims of the 2017-2018 fires, they say that the DNA for this kind of culture shift inside PG&E, that they really saw it play out in 2010 in San Bruno, when a gas line blew up a suburban community, destroyed, I think, 36 homes, and killed 8 people. Its malfeasance and negligence in that was, well, it was found to be criminal. And that tragedy did not change the way PG&E did business. And so what happened in that suburban community then ends up happening in the forest.
And so what role exactly did PG&E play in the Paradise Fire?
PG&E has quite a chore. I mean, they're the biggest utility in the country, and they're having to deliver power to all these growing communities, and they're stretching, they're freighting this power across great swaths of forest land. It's not an easy job, but they've been very negligent in taking out trees, and also they've been poor at replacing aged kind of infrastructure. And so there was a tower that was so old that it let go of this piece of equipment. It just fell in the high winds, and that's what set the fire that day.
So it was a live wire.
It was a live wire that was, it broke free of its clasp from this metal tower 100 feet tall.
And PG&E also didn't shut the power off that day, even though they knew there was going to be low humidity and high winds.
Perfect wildfire conditions. They even called all the folks in Butte, you know, all the people in the Ridge community, sent out text messages and everything saying that be prepared, we're going to turn off the power. And for some reason, they didn't.
Do other power companies in the state of California do things differently?
It's a great question. They do. If you compare the statistics, you'll find that PG&E sets a lot more fires than Southern California Edison or San Diego Pacific Gas and Electric. Those other two utilities learned some real lessons out of the wildfires of the early 2000s. And they put in weather stations. They were able to monitor things. They had a policy of turning off the electricity in high winds. PG&E never adopted those changes or were slow to adopt them. They're only doing that now.
And this goes way back. You mentioned the Rough and Ready fire in Nevada County in 1994 that apparently was caused by PG&E's failure to prune back vegetation surrounding its power lines, and it destroyed 12 homes and a historic schoolhouse. But what you mentioned in the article that really shocked me was even back then, the utility had diverted $495 million from its tree trimming budget to increase corporate payoffs.
Time and again, PG&E took money that should have gone to safety and ended up putting it in the pockets of their executives and their shareholders. And in a courtroom in San Francisco, a federal judge who was weighing whether or not PG&E needs to have even more constraints put upon it after being found a felon, a corporate felon, he has been challenging them. This guy named Alsup, Judge Alsup, a Mississippian 73-year-old guy who's wrapping their knuckles every time they appear, and you know, he keeps underscoring this point that money that should have gone to safety went into executive and shareholder profits.
So how does a company get away with that?
That is the question. It gets away with it because we have a watchdog, the California Public Utilities Commission, that isn't a watchdog. The relationship over the years, and that is something that I really examine in this piece, the relationship between PG&E and the CPUC, the California Public Utilities, it's really close. And in fact, they write letters for each other. And so we don't have a watchdog, and PG&E exerts such power, you know, they can get away with it. I mean, the judge essentially said they got away with murder.
So one last question. You had mentioned earlier that our state's population is exploding in some of the most susceptible areas to fires. And that's kind of the question at the heart of your book, The Dreamt Land, which is, you know, what's going to give? How much more can we grow in this state? Any answers on that?
Yeah, the book and this piece are all about the system that we built, this magnificent system, and it's cracking. And will it see us into a future of more houses in the farm belt, more houses across the desert, more houses in the wildland urban interface, more almond trees? I don't know. We don't seem to be willing to ask ourselves that question, which to me is the question that we should begin with. How big can we get? Where, you know, we're talking now about building a million and if not more affordable houses. Into what safe zone are we going to build these houses? It's weird that the gold rush happened a long time ago, but its mentality is with us. That supercharged way we began, we seem to think that we can continue to outrace our nature. And now our nature is linking up to global climate change. I'm not sure we can outrun that.
And when you have 85 people dying in a situation like this that probably could have been prevented, it makes the question even more important.
It does. And that's the question I leave there with. As some of the people that I've spent months with, they're going back and they're planning to rebuild right there again. And they explain to you in a way that makes sense on an emotional level why they want to do that. This is their home. And then you drive down that ridge and you go past the city of Sacramento. And if you know a little California history, you know that John Sutter basically founded our state capital right where two mighty rivers meet, you know, the worst floodplain in all of California. So there's our original sin.
Again, we've been talking to writer Mark Erex about his recent piece, Gone, in the California Sunday Magazine about the town of Paradise. He's also the author of the recent book, The Dreamt Land, Chasing Water and Dust Across California. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Alice.